The final frontier begins.
This is about saving the future of humanity.
This is a huge victory for the good guys.
You've never seen Voyager.
Commitment to this course of action is not emotional.
Scotty, beam us up.
Welcome to another episode of Beam Me Up, a Star Trek podcast. My name is Brent Allen, and I have seen every episode of Star Trek 47 times.
Wow. And I am Matt Sonnenberg, and this is my first time through the series.
Not just the series, but all the series, because Matt, while this may be the show where we are on a mission to introduce as many people as we can to the Star Trek universe by watching the most important episodes that deal with the lore, history, and timeless message of Star Trek, this is your first time watching a brand new Star Trek series, Deep Space Nine, and I can't wait to get into this one today.
Well, Brent, just like Deep Space Nine can tie together the Borg, Cardassians, the Bajorans, our website can tie together our podcast, our social media, and our email. So if you want to get a hold of us, look no further than beammeuppod.com. That's the place to be. We'll see you there.
Today's episode, as I just referenced, is the very first episode of Deep Space Nine titled Emissary, or as I like to call it, don't call it a pilot, it's a premiere. In case you guys didn't watch this one first, this is the one where the brand new commander, Ben Sisko, actually he's not new, he's been around for a while, but he's new to us, Benjamin Sisko takes command of the Bajoran space station, has a whole bunch of issues, including his own personal ones to deal with throughout the course of the episode. Matt, before we get into all the nitty gritty of the episode, you've watched Deep Space Nine, the first episode, the premiere episode. Give us your opening thoughts as we come out of this. I'm sorry, before we do that, let's remind people real quick. You have just come off of Next Generation watching Chain of Command. And this is the, for people out there who may be wondering, like, this was the next episode of Star Trek that aired on TV when people were originally watching it. Chain of Command. Yeah. Chain of Command set up Emissary for us with one quick little line at the very beginning of the episode and then gave us a real deep look into the bad guys that we're going to get to know. And going forward, because the two shows really are companion shows that go hand in hand and oftentimes cross their subject matter, even though they're not always crossover episodes. So we're going to watch these in air date order of the original, you know, original airings of all these episodes. So that's where we are. That's what you're coming off of. We're not done with Next Generation yet. You are just now starting. We're mixing in Deep Space Nine. Opening thoughts, sir, if you please.
It's a mess.
The space station or the show? Let's get clear.
Both.
Oh my.
Maybe not like from a production standpoint, maybe they know what they're doing, but it's a lot to take in.
Yes.
I mean, even with my limited knowledge of Star Trek, and I can see even more so why you have you watch specific episodes, can like they just tied these three episodes into this first episode of Deep Space Nine. Okay. Wasn't expecting that. It's a lot of content and a lot of, I just don't know where to start with this episode. And and I honestly think that this transition episode, if you will, is just going to be a lot messier than what is to come, or at least I hope.
Okay.
I hope things get into a little bit more of a routine. I hope things get a little bit clearer about who's who and like it's because right now, like, we got this mess of like we got Picard and O'Brien, who I already know, but then, you know, we got all these new characters, and then we keep getting flashbacks to his old ship, and I'm like, what are we doing here?
All in good time, Matthew. All in good time. Yes, I 100% know what you mean. I always say, Matt, most television shows, you and I have talked about this a ton of times.
Yeah.
Deep Space Nine is no different. The first several seasons can be really, really rough.
Yeah.
They really can be, because you're introducing new characters. The writers are getting to know the characters. The actors are getting to know the characters. Things are fleshing out. They may try something, go, that doesn't work, let's switch it for the next episode. Different things like that are happening all the time. Most most of the actors, and I think you're only marginally aware of this, but let me make it super clear right now. Most of these actors are Shakespearean stage actors.
Okay.
Which they're making so the jump.
They're still doing that.
They are, but they're also making the jump to series television. Mm-hmm. Some for the first time, some maybe for a second or third time, something like that. But this is really a new jump for them. And so there's a little bit of carrying that over. Go ahead.
You would think Patrick Stewart would have some tips for the newcomers. Like he should have like a onboarding course that they have to take.
Because he was good from episode one. Everyone else.
The fact that he's been at it for 5-6 years now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he's working with them at least on this first episode. I don't know how often we'll see him. I'm assuming he's not going to be in every episode, but
that would be a fair assumption.
I think that'd be kind of weird and right. Probably a little bit overload, but I think they have people not only associated with the show, but directly working with the show that mm-hmm. have made that type of transition before.
Right.
So, you know, give them a few tips, a few pointers, mm-hmm. make that transition easier.
Yeah. These episodes, Matt, are always hard to do. They really are. And when I went in to do the research on this episode, Matt, I can promise you, and I will tell you, this was by far, Matt, I mean, not even close, the longest noted episode that we have ever done on Beam Me Up. Like the notes for this episode just kept going on and on and on and on and on about the concept, the development, the struggles that they had, what it meant while they were to do that, while they were doing Next Gen, the things that they were going to carry over, things that they weren't, because there are some things that they had gotten experience on Next Gen that they just brought over, like makeup. Now there's still some makeup issues that are going to be changed and tweaked as we go forward, and you'll notice those as that happens. But for the most part, they know how to do makeup. They know how to build a set. They know how to light it. They know how to position their all the technical stuff of creating an episode. Mm-hmm. They know how to do that. What does it mean to outfit this with this particular group of characters, this particular actors, with these backstories and bringing all this together for the very first time? That's hard, because this is an episode where you have to introduce everybody on the show, like all seven characters, right? You've got to give them all minus a backstory.
Two.
Do what?
Minus two.
Minus two. Well, yeah. I mean,
there are two that are coming over from Next Gen, so you don't really need to introduce them.
There's two. There's O'Brien. Picard, let's not count Picard, because he's as you said, he's not going to continue on this show. Okay, this is his cameo. He's not
coming over, but this first episode.
Sure.
But
we already know him.
They don't need introductions.
Uh-huh. But what we do need for O'Brien, though, is we need the why is he moving? Like, we need some sort of justification to make us go, hey, we know him, and he's moving over. Because we've only, with O'Brien so far, we've only ever sort of peripherally known him, right? Like, we know him better than we do, say, Lieutenant Junior J. Exactly.
Is that an actual character?
Yes, it is. It's one of the background characters that's in like every other episode of Star Trek Next Generation. We know O'Brien way better than that, but we still don't know him. So we have to give a little bit over to him. But for everybody else, I mean, you still have a main cast of seven or eight people. We've got to introduce all of those people, give you at least a little bit of all of their backstories. We have to introduce the bad guys, not just as an alien race, but specific individuals in the bad guys, give them a little bit of a backstory, and then have a plot that sets in motion the events of the rest of the series. And this episode, to me, and I think you're feeling that, I could be wrong, tell me if this rings true with you or not, that I think is what you're feeling, is there's so much having to be crammed into this episode that it's hard to do a lot extremely well.
Like I said, it's a mess.
It's a mess. And
that's what I'm feeling. Yes.
Your boy, Michael Piller, felt very much the same way. They were satisfied with how this episode came off, but they weren't loving it. But they also recognized this is just the premiere episode.
Yeah.
Go up, get better.
That's one of those, if you can get them hooked on this okay episode, you'll be fine.
Right.
Dude, it's what you and I have been talking about in the podcasting world, right? Mm-hmm. When you're first starting out with your podcast, it's okay if it's not perfect.
Right.
Focus on the content. You can improve the rest of the show later.
Exactly. Now, I will agree with you. I do think that this episode meanders a bit too much for my taste. Again, I just think that that's by necessity, so I can't really fault the episode. I think it's just the nature of the beast in many ways. At least how they did episodes like this back in the early 90s, because this is 1993, right?
Okay.
So that's where we are in history. The way we do television now, we don't have to introduce every character in the very first episode. We can bring them along as episodes continue. You just focus on the one main character usually in that first episode. So,
And you see that's a good point though, too. It's like, I think if I was watching this back in the early 90s, this probably would have been great. It probably would have been, you know, a little bit ahead of its time almost. I think that's with a lot of Star Trek.
Yes.
It's if you watch it in the context of its time, it is doing fantastic things.
Yes.
But now we looking back on it 27 years later, it's like, why didn't you do it like we do TV today?
Exactly. Exactly. Because, and Matt, I'm going to make this statement right here at the outset. The way that we do TV today owes its existence to what they did on Deep Space Nine specifically. And you're going to see what I mean as we go through this.
Sure.
Deep Space Nine is still episodic television. They when this goes into syndication, they may or may not play it in order. So there has to be some sort of show opens. We have an adventure. Show closes kind of at the where we started it, you know? But this show will begin to break that down a lot. And you'll see what we mean. Now, I will say this to you with 100% certainty. This entire series, including this episode, I realized this, I think, for the first time watching it in preparation for this podcast. This whole series is so, so, so much better on the rewatch. Once you have completed the entire thing, you know what's going on. You can really appreciate many of the master strokes
that occur
in this episode that pay off in the finale episode, that pay off throughout the series as it goes forward. They are leaving so many breadcrumbs and they're starting to sow so many ideas and so many thoughts that are going to get picked up throughout the series. And they're going to bring them to a really, Matt, I want to say a very satisfying conclusion. I think Deep Space Nine, of all the series that I've ever seen, probably has the most satisfying conclusion of any Star Trek. And there's a reason why it's one of the favorites among the fans out there. However, like every other Star Trek series out there, though, got to get through the first couple of seasons. Here's the other thing, though. All those breadcrumbs and everything that I mentioned, what makes it even better is this was not a show where they had it mapped out beginning to end. They didn't really know where it was going to go. They had a couple of ideas, but they really fleshed it out along the way. So the fact that the writers had enough wherewithal, they had people who were in control of it the entire way, that they were able to go back and incorporate everything and say, hey, we can pick that up, or we can draw on that idea, or we can move that forward. I think you're going to enjoy the series a lot, Matt, a whole lot. And that being said, I just want to give a word to the listeners out there. We are going to have to change many ways of how we do episodes here at Beam Me Up. And this is going to fall mostly on my shoulders. Matt's not going to have any idea of what I'm doing. But for those of you guys out there who know, this series has a lot going on with it. And the episodes that we are going to pick, the episodes we're going to have to watch, is going to be one of those things. I equate it to like making a movie from a book, where there's so much content. You basically, when you make the movie, you have to pick the core storyline and stick with that and do all of that content. And if things don't stick to that, if it's just sort of supplemental, those are the things that have to fall away. And that's how we're going to pick and choose these episodes, Matt, is there is a core story that is running through this entire series. And we're going to do the episodes that relate to that core story, if that makes sense. And the ones that will fall away, the ones that will fall away will be the ones that don't affect that core story. That doesn't mean that it's not happening. It doesn't mean they're not good. It doesn't mean it's not worth a rewatch. And you absolutely should go back and rewatch this entire series when you can binge it properly. Okay. But for us and our purposes here, this is changing from the way we've done Next Generation and even the way we've done TOS. So you'll understand the core of what Deep Space Nine is about by the time we're done, which is really the point here, you know? So with that, Matthew, one more thing to get to before we get into the episode. And there's a lot to talk about here. Character actor spotlights for what we're doing. I want to go through these relatively quickly. Let's start with a few people that we know that we see there. You've already mentioned, Patrick Stewart is here as Jean-Luc Picard and Locutus of Borg.
Mm-hmm.
And also Prophet Picard and Prophet Borg Locutus as well. Mark Alimo is back as Gul Dukat. Now, Matt, we have mentioned Mark Alimo several times here recently. I've been dropping his name on purpose fairly heavily for you. Most recently, Matt, do you remember where you saw him? The folks out there wouldn't know this, so just you and I would know this right now.
Should I?
It was an extra viewing episode that we did called Time's Arrow.
Oh, okay.
And Mark Alimo, the guy who plays Gul Dukat, was the card shark, the guy in the red suit, the card shark at the at the table with Data. He also, we've also seen him in Next Generation a handful of times before, playing other Cardassians, playing a Romulan all the way back in season one. But I don't mind telling you that Mark Alimo is going to leave his mark on Star Trek through the character of Gul Dukat, who is going to reappear 30 some odd times. Yeah. 30 some odd times over the course of
After seeing him in like these past two episodes, like I kind of figure like this is going to be a thing.
He'll be a guy.
Like you've kind of driven it home a little bit with the Cardassians now, and it's like, okay, they're going to be a thing. Now they're in the introductory episode, the premiere episode of Deep Space Nine. I don't think they're going away anytime soon.
Right. Exactly. And Gul Dukat's going to be, he's the former commander of the station. So there's going to be a lot there. All right. Anyway, finally, as far as people that we already know, we have Colm Meaney back, who is playing Chief Miles Edward O'Brien. Matt, you know him. Mm-hmm. You just didn't know that you loved him, but you will love him now. he is here as a series regular on the show. He is making the transition. We're going to talk more about Colm later on a future spotlight. So I'm going to save everything about him for a future show. But that is him. He is transitioning over.
Can I just say now, I feel like he is going to be the Geordi of this series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Same role. Yep. Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. And there's a theme. I don't know if we're going to watch it. I don't know how many times we're going to hit it, but there's sort of this running gag in Deep Space Nine that if they don't know what to do, like they're trying to make an episode, they got to fill out 26 of these a season, right? If they don't know what to do for an episode, the mantra is make O'Brien suffer. And there's, Matt, if we ever come back and do like a series of episodes, it will be O'Brien suffering episodes because they're terrific.
I believe it because even just in this first episode, it's like they give him all the worst equipment and like he knows he should be able to make it work, but it's just it's not.
Yeah, right.
Until he kicks the console. But
you're gonna love O'Brien, and you're gonna O'Brien has one of the best. Well, we'll save that. We'll get into that. O'Brien's great. You're gonna love him anyway. So those are characters we know. Let's talk about a couple of new characters, Matt. Now there are a lot of new characters. And kind of like we did with Next Generation, I'm not going to go through all of them here. Basically, I'll wait till we get to a centric episode on that character, and then we'll highlight that particular person.
Yeah.
So I want to give you a few people that I want to highlight that may not make that particular type of highlight, but I just want to point them out here because they're in the pilot episode. First, the young Ferengi who gets arrested, Quark's nephew. His name is Nog. He's played by a guy named Aaron Eisenberg, who in our world, in real life, just recently passed away. So RIP to Aaron. He means a lot to the Star Trek community. We are going to see a lot more from Nog as we go on. He's actually in more episodes than Gul Dukat is. So he will be around quite a bit. Now the Ferengi pit boss, who was ever so briefly on camera as it was just panning across Quark's bar right after they reopened.
Okay.
That guy's name is Rom, and he is played by a guy named Max Grodenchik. Now Rom will later be revealed to be Quark's brother, who is Nog's father. And he and Nog will just sort of be, they're not series regulars, but they are regular recurring characters.
Like I kind of wondered if his brother was still alive even or on the station or whatever. Cause the way that Quark came in and kind of defended him, and it's like, he's my brother's boy. At that point I wasn't sure. It's like, okay, is his brother still around to take care of him, or are you in charge of him even though he's not, you know, your son?
Right.
Cause that was my first guess, was like, that's his son. And they quickly cleared that up. I'm like, it's my brother's boy. I'm like, okay, got it. Nephew.
Right. And you'll, like I said, you'll meet Rom. You'll get to know Rom really well. You'll get to know Nog pretty well going forward as well, too. Another person I want to point out is the Vulcan captain of the USS Saratoga. This was Sisko's ship that exploded at the beginning of the episode.
Yep.
Okay. Where Sisko was the first officer. He was the lieutenant commander there.
Okay. Okay. I was trying to figure that out. Cause like, I as much as they were focusing on him on that ship, I kept thinking, well, he's the captain. He's the captain. Mm-hmm. And then like later on, when they go down, when he's talking with his son, mm-hmm. By the pond and he gets called on the comms, mm-hmm. and it's like, it's the captain calling him.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, so he's not a captain now. And I like looked at his lapel and like, okay, he's only got three.
Yep.
So he's a commander. Fine. But
I love the fact that you know that, Matt. I love the fact that you know to look at the pips and that tells you where they are. I love that.
But it like, I still didn't know if he took a step back from, you know, leading his own ship at that point,
right.
or if it like I still didn't know what was going on. So thank you for clearing that up, that he hasn't been the captain at all.
He has not been the captain. Right. And when he starts here in Deep Space Nine, he is the commander. He is not Captain Sisko. He is the commander. Yes. And I will leave that there and we'll continue. However, I do want to talk about that captain. The Vulcan captain of the Saratoga. He is played by a guy named J.G. Hertzler. In fact, I think his name in the credits was something different for this particular episode. Matt, you don't know him. To Star Trek fans, though, his voice is a dead giveaway. As soon as you hear him talk, you go, that's Martok, because he will be back to play a role called Martok several seasons down the road. You will meet Martok. You will love Martok. And later on, when I go back and say, hey, that Vulcan captain, that was the guy who played Martok, you'd be like, oh my gosh. So for all of you out there who've seen the show before, that's Martok. And I'm not spoiling anything, but I just point him out. We'll talk about him. He'll probably have his own character spotlight later on. One more before I get to the main cast spotlight I want to talk about today. We have a new computer voice, Matt. The Cardassian computers, I don't know if you noticed this or not, have a different voice than the Federation computers.
I didn't really think about it, but
they didn't.
Sure.
The lady who does the Cardassian computers is named Judy Duran. You wouldn't know her at all. She's nowhere near like what Majel Roddenberry was, who'd just been in everything Star Trek before starting to do the computer voice. Don't worry. Majel Roddenberry is still doing all the Starfleet computers, like in the runabouts and the starships and things like that, that we will see throughout the course of the show. However, most of what we're going to hear, because it'll be on the station, will be Judy. This is a small detail, Matt, that I love that the producers thought of, because they didn't have to. It would have been real easy to understand that they just put in their computer core and there's the voice that we're all used to, but they didn't. They chose to go with a new voice for the...
It makes a lot more sense.
It does. It really does. And it's interesting when you hear the two computers almost side by side. They are very different. So just wanted to point that out as well, too. Finally, getting all the way down to the end so we can actually get into the episode. Our main cast spotlight today, who could it be? Anyone other than Commander Sisko. This is his show. He is the number one on the call sheet. So let's talk about Sisko as we drop an actual spotlight on him. Commander Benjamin Sisko is played by a guy named Avery Brooks. Matt, do you recognize Avery at all?
I feel like I should, but I couldn't tell you why.
If you were a fan of the 1980s show Spencer for Hire or the spinoff of A Man Called Hawk, that would be where you would probably have seen Avery Brooks before.
Nope.
That's what he did before coming over here. Now, he is playing the first African-American lead on a Star Trek show, putting him in command, which was very important to him. And this was a big deal back in the 90s. To place an African American in the lead role of an episode or of a show that isn't specifically a quote unquote black show. Does that make sense? In fact, speaking about this role, Avery Brooks said the strength of the pilot emissary, in which a single human being must defend all humankind against some other intelligence in the universe, was especially appealing. Avery said that the human being selected as a person of color says a lot about the spirit of the entire series and gives hope to the children of all races that they can affect positive change in both their lives and in the lives of others. And Brooks held that very, very tightly. He also very much held the idea that that Benjamin and Jake, the father and son, would have a great relationship and a very strong relationship. He very much wanted to show a black father and a black son in a strong, bonded, positive relationship. And that was very important to him. And I bring it up because it's not just some social justice thing to say. It was actually important to the actor. And I think it was very, very much important to the series going forward. And I think it's one of those reasons, Matt, it's one of those subtle reasons why we sit back and say the world needs Star Trek more than ever, because Star Trek does stuff like that, even without directly coming out and saying it. They just put it on air and show it to you. And it's normal, you know? So I love that. Now, that said, Avery Brooks is a performer through and through. He was born into a musical family. He is a very, very accomplished jazz musician, and it's often noted when he's at a convention, if he sees a piano, he will jump on stage and just start playing the piano, and he will only leave when he feels like it, oftentimes staying for hours. There's a documentary where William Shatner went around to talk to all of the leads of the different shows, and he does the interview with Avery Brooks at Avery's home at his piano, and Avery is basically playing his piano through the entire interview. It's just weird, but it's awesome. And Avery is, he's amazing when it comes to that sort of stuff. Avery was also the first African-American to receive an MFA, a Master's in Fine Arts in acting and directing from Rutgers University in New Jersey, where he will eventually go on to become a professor while he is on this show. And he will become like the department chair, head of their drama department there at Rutgers University, first African-American to also hold that spot. He has an extensive stage background, like I mentioned earlier, in Shakespeare. He is one of those Shakespearean actors. And then I also mentioned, he was cast as the role of Hawk in a show called Spencer for Hire. He was sort of the sidekick. And then he got his own spinoff called A Man Called Hawk. Now, prior to Trek, Brooks had a very signature look, Matt, and you have to know this about him. If you Google Avery Brooks and you look at him, what you're going to see is not Commander Sisko. You're going to see a guy with a shaved bald head and an awesome goatee. Okay. And it is such an awesome, awesome look. That was his Avery Brooks's look. For whatever reason, the production really wanted to distance him from that role, so they made him shave his goatee and grow out his hair. Now, I don't mind telling you that, well, let me back up. Avery Brooks says, even to this day, that he always had a hard time acting with this new look because it never felt like him. So if there were places where his performance feels stiff and unnatural, for whatever reason, the way he looked affected how he was acting and how he changed. Eventually, he will come back to the producers and be like, hey, can I just go back to my old look? And they will let him do that. And Matt, I'm telling you, when that happens, when you see the goatee and then when you see him shave his head, that is a marking point to this series where everything just skyrockets, including Avery's performance. And I'm not saying Avery was bad in these first several seasons, but and different little things. You're like, what are you doing? Some of that really has to do with, for whatever reason, he was just uncomfortable in front of the camera with this look that he had. And it's as simple as that.
Okay.
It's just as simple as that. Avery is going to go on to appear in every single episode of Deep Space Nine. He will be here for all seven seasons. However, Matt, he did almost leave the show during the early years, but after having a conversation with his own son about what it means to keep your word and your promise, he decided that he was going to stay the length of his contract and the length of the run of the show. During the show, I mentioned he became a professor at his alma mater. He started doing classes in his costume, sometimes video recording his lesson and sending it via VHS. If you remember those, that really dates the show back to the university to have his lecture. He will also join the growing list of Star Trek alumni who turned directors, and he will direct 9 episodes of Deep Space Nine during his run here. But Matt, like so many others, I will always remember Avery Brooks best for his role on the hit animated series Gargoyles. All right, that's not true. I'm going to remember him as Ben Sisko the most, but he, like so many other Star Trek people, had a turn on Gargoyles. All right, Matt, now that you're fully versed in who Avery Brooks is, who our Commander Sisko is, why don't we go through this episode? What do you say? 32 minutes into the show. All right, here we go. Emissary, can't even call it 1 and 2. This premiered as a single episode. In syndication later, they split it into two, but it really was just one. Oh, let's also talk about that just real quick. The reason this isn't a pilot and it's a premiere is because it opened with a full season order. Like, a pilot is a, let's shoot it and see if it has legs and they'll see if somebody wants to pick it up. That wasn't the case. It began already having a full season order ready to go. So that's this was weird. Just the premiere episode.
Okay.
Just so you know. That said, prologue. The time is 3 years ago. The place is the Battle of Wolf 359. Picard is Locutus, and the Borg are kicking the tail of the entire Federation fleet. This is the scene that we didn't get to see in Best of Both Worlds. On one of those ships in the battle, the USS Saratoga, it gets caught in the Borg tractor beam. Suddenly, an explosion not only rocks the bridge, but it damages the warp core. Surviving Senior Officer Commander Ben Sisko orders an evac of the entire ship. The only problem is he can't find his family. It wasn't just the bridge that got rocked. The rest of the ship is in pretty bad order as well. Sisko eventually finds his son, who is injured but alive, and then he finds his wife, who is already dead, buried beneath the rubble. Against his will, Sisko is dragged from that room, leaving her there as he escapes on the escape pod, watching from the window as the ship blows up.
So this is the huge battle scene, well, battle going poorly scene that we don't usually see on Star Trek.
Right. And if you remember in Best of Both Worlds, we only came to the tail end of it because of budgetary concerns. They couldn't actually show us the battle. So here they created the battle of Wolf 359 for us to actually see what happened.
Well, they created 5 minutes of it from one ship's perspective. Yes.
Well, right. But it's more than what we got in Battle or Best of Both Worlds.
Fair enough.
But yes, this is the one.
Yeah, it's really fast paced and lots of explosions and a lot of confusion because I know zero of these people.
Right.
And I don't like, other than, okay, I guess we're following Sisko around, but at that time, I don't know who Sisko is and I don't even know his name really. And it's like, I don't know who I should be paying attention to. And but like, part of it clicked through, like, this is going to be, they're introducing a whole crew and
it's not
going to be gone in 5 minutes. Like that's a weird opening. But yeah, so like, because we really only get, who do we get out of there? We get Sisko and we get Jake
in the next scene. Yeah.
And I guess that's Jennifer is sort of introduced.
Yeah.
Enough to, we know her relation and she does come back a little bit later, but now that I look at my notes, I think there's a mention of a Doran.
No clue.
Okay.
There might've been, I have never paid attention because
I don't think that came back ever again. So because it was Sisko shouting out names, and I think that was the first one, and then Jennifer and then Jake. And we only picked up on Jennifer and Jake later on, so okay, whatever. But yeah, that was the opening.
Yeah. Think about that though, the idea that we're picking up the story of somebody else in Starfleet who was affected by one of the biggest events in Starfleet history, right? Alpha Quadrant history specifically. And we're going to kind of follow them. We're going to see what happened with them. And in this case, he lost his wife, almost lost his son, lost his ship. And
basically taking what was a B plot or even C plot of a different episode and saying, hey, we're going to make a series out of this.
Yeah. Yeah. You know who I've always wondered about, Matt, like who's in that? Superhero movies, is the person in the office building that gets smashed up by the two superheroes, or the superhero and the super villain fighting in the middle of downtown New York. Like, what about the guy whose office was that window that just got smashed in by Spider-Man throwing Doc Ock through the wall?
Yeah.
You know,
I guess we don't get like,
what about that person's family at home?
Of the everyman. But yeah. I think that's kind of the feeling that I get from like J. Jonah Jameson, right?
Right. Yeah.
But like he has a little bit higher seat of power, but I mean, he is that guy who's watching, kind of, you know, that citizen who is watching all of the superheroes do their thing and cause the commotion, destroy everything. And so we get that a little bit, but yeah.
Right.
He obviously has a different objective.
And then we also get, and this really comes up later on, so maybe we should save this conversation, but it plants the seed right here. Like, we saw Picard get abducted. We saw how horrible that was. We saw Picard come back. We saw Picard go through his remorse and his sort of therapy episode, and we've seen Picard since. But if we ever stop to think about the people who suffered at the hands of, when they look at a guy like Picard and that's all that they can see is the death and suffering of what happened, like we set that up for a little bit, but that's also who we get here.
And we'll talk about that.
Let's save that conversation for when we get there. But to me, this was a brilliant way to bring back in, or to at least set up again, got to set up the backstory of who these people are and where they're coming from. Finishing out the prologue, present day, a somewhat more cheerful Commander Sisko is coming to get his son Jake, who isn't having much luck fishing off a pier. They're headed to a space station in orbit of the newly freed Bajor. Hey, remember that from last episode? Cardassia pulled out. Speaking of which, Sisko gets a message that they've arrived. Hey, wait a minute. This isn't a pond. It's a holodeck. They head out, agreeing to take the pond with them. And from out of a window, they and we get our first look of Deep Space Nine.
Which is the space station.
Go figure. Yes. And it's huge. Mm-hmm. Did you catch an idea of the size of it? Like when you saw the Enterprise right up next to it docked and everything.
I think that's the best thing because I don't have a grasp of how big some of these other ships are, but I know how big the Enterprise is and is supposed to be compared to everything else. So yeah, when the Enterprise pulled up next to it, it's like, oh, okay.
It's pretty
big. That's a pretty big station. Yeah, it's interesting. But yeah, then the credits roll and I appreciated these credits, especially for my purposes, that they gave me, it wasn't just a list of actor names, right? It was a list of actors as the
characters. Okay, cool. I don't think I've ever thought about that before, but okay.
I made a list of them just so I'm like, okay, if I run across these people, I should know them.
Now you know who they are. There you go.
Yes. There are eight people in this list.
Okay.
It is Commander Sisko.
Right.
Odo.
Uh-huh.
Dr. Bashir.
Uh-huh.
Lieutenant Dax.
Uh-huh.
Jake Sisko.
Uh-huh.
Chief O'Brien.
Uh-huh.
Quark. And Major Kira.
When you saw Chief O'Brien, did you go, hey, wait a minute. Did that click in yet when you saw Chief O'Brien?
Well yeah, Chief O'Brien and Cole Meany. Like, I recognize the name even. Like,
Okay. So you did recognize it just from seeing the name in the opening credits?
Yeah. So I knew who it was. I didn't know what role he was going to play, but it's like, oh, gotcha. Okay, you made opening credits. Good for you.
There you go. Yeah, and Kira. Hey, let's talk real quick about two things having to do with the opening credits while we're here. We don't usually talk about the opening credits, but it's a new show. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about it. The version that you saw, what happened at the end of the credits? Do you remember?
I couldn't tell you. I don't think.
For most people, it's a panning shot of like an asteroid going by, and then it goes over and it pans around the space station while it gives you all the opening names. And then it gives you an establishing shot of the thing, of the space station while a runabout flies away. And then the wormhole opens up and the little runabout flies into the space station and it shuts off. And that's the end of the thing of the opening credits, except for when they originally aired the pilot, they didn't have the wormhole open at the end of the credits because they hadn't discovered it yet. And they wanted to save the surprise of that effect of it popping open in the show.
Yeah, I didn't even think about it. And I wasn't paying close enough attention. But I'm going to have to.
I never noticed that until I read about it in research for this particular episode. I never knew that. Now, granted, I didn't watch Deep Space Nine until about probably 10 years after it premiered.
I was going to say, you maybe never saw original.
Did not see the original run of that. I did not come to Star Trek until Voyager was airing. So this again was a bit before my time. So I don't know if I've ever seen that particular episode without the wormhole opening up. They did eventually change it to the one with the wormhole opening up as they put it on repeat. I'm not sure why they would go back and change it, because you've got to be intentional to go do that. Yep. But that's just a little note about that. For those of you, if you're wondering if you're getting the original show, it's the one without the wormhole. And it's the only episode in the entire run that doesn't have the wormhole open up at the end of the credits.
Yeah. There'd be no reason not to.
Yeah. The other person I want to point out, and we'll do the character spotlight later, but Kira Nerys, let's talk about her just for a second.
I don't think we got that in this episode.
Oh, you didn't. Well, remember, she's Bajoran. So her family name is actually Kira, and her first name, her family name would be Nerys, or her personal name, like Ro Laren. Ro is her family name, but Laren's her personal name. Anyway, speaking of Ro Laren, and if you remember going all the way back to that particular episode of Next Generation, I debated for a long time whether or not to put Ensign Ro in the show, right? But I did, because it introduced the Bajorans to us. And it turns out the Bajorans are going to be pretty big, as you may guess now at this point, Matt, in the Star Trek universe, right? This show was originally meant to have Ro Laren as the number one officer on Deep Space Nine, right next to Commander Sisko.
Hmm.
That's how it was written. That's why the space station is in orbit of Bajor. That's why the Cardassians are now the bad guys. That's why the show is set up the way it is. Except Michelle Forbes, who played Ensign Ro, decided she didn't want to be in a series. So she opted out.
Weird.
And so Michael Piller and Rick Berman had to go back and they had to rewrite like three scenes. And all they did was, instead of changing the whole thing, they just turned Ensign Ro into Kira Nerys, into Major Kira. But they felt like it actually worked out in their favor, because now they could have Kira as a Bajoran commander, not somebody in Starfleet, which then, you know, television thrives on conflict, even even in Star Trek, and it set up more conflict between Sisko and his number one than what would have been allowed if Ensign Ro had been there as a member of Starfleet. So they feel like it was a fortuitous change that happened, but that is the reason why this show is set where it is and has the people that it's there, and that person's not even in the show.
Sure.
So there you go. So you have that. Yeah, I guess that's it for that. Why don't we move on? Act one. All right, here's the deal. The Cardassians have recently ended their occupation of the Bajoran homeworld. At the request of the Bajoran provisional government, Starfleet is establishing a presence in the system, and that presence will be on this abandoned space station. Commander Sisko will be in command. Not everyone has arrived yet, but a few have, including the new chief of operations, Miles Edward O'Brien. So I guess that explains why the Enterprise was parked outside. Also, see chain of command. They just got away. Had to drop somebody off really quickly afterwards. They happen to be in the neighborhood, right?
Uh-huh.
Sisko and O'Brien are touring the promenade. Man, this place is really trashed. The Cardassians stripped the station of everything of value before leaving, even to the extent of killing a few of the Bajoran shop owners. Everyone left is packing up to leave. That includes a couple of Ferengi packing up what looks like a bar. A spiritual leader of the Bajoran comes out of his quote-unquote church there on the promenade to tell Commander Sisko the prophets await. Sisko politely declines and carries on. In a conversation about the state of their quarters, they're going to try to get some halfway decent furniture and food sent over from the Enterprise, but until these things get cleaned up and back to working, they're going to have to rough it. But hey, there's no time for that now. Captain Picard wants to see Commander Sisko. Yeah, he's not so eager for that visit.
Yeah, it didn't even click why he was kind of avoiding Picard right away. But obviously, by the time they meet, it's like, oh, yeah, OK, that makes sense. Gotcha. Mm-hmm. But yes, OK, the prophets await you.
Like, yeah,
this guy's creepy. Seems out of place, but they're making a big deal about him.
Uh-huh.
Should probably pay attention to that.
Right.
Later on, I figured out who this guy reminds me of.
Uh-huh.
He reminds me of the in Indiana Jones in Last Crusade, the guy, the knight guarding the Holy Grail.
That's who. Yeah. Okay. I can see that. You have chosen pork.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's funny. Yeah. He is known as a Prylor or something like that. Basically, it's a monk. And if you haven't figured it out yet, Matt, a good portion of this particular episode is going to deal with the Bajoran religious system.
Yep.
Or belief system, faith system.
Yeah, I didn't know it at this point, but yeah.
Yeah.
We get there.
Yeah. So this guy is he's effectively a monk, and he's running a church on the space station of all places.
Well, like you told me, you didn't tell me about space stations, but I mean, if space ships have like not civilizations, but entire communities on them.
I mean, this one has a mall.
Yeah.
A promenade, but it's a mall. Right?
When you go down to the space station, I mean, because Sisko tells Jake, like consider this like shore leave.
Yeah.
Like, so yeah, there should be things for them to do, things for them to, I could see, yes, having a church. I can see having a mall. I can see having all these things. Mm-hmm. Like, it makes sense. Like, it should be like a city,
right,
in space.
Yeah.
Because people are living here and other people are visiting here when they're on their breaks. And
the only thing that gets me about this is, at least at this point in time, the space station is in orbit of the planet Bajor. Like, it's not like this is a space station just out in the middle of space with nothing around it. Like,
sure.
Like, to start, it's actually in orbit of Bajor. Like, it's right there, you know? So now later it gets moved, obviously, and we'll get there. But I can see the other side of it, because when you did, what's your understanding? Let me ask you this, Matt. What is your understanding of what was happening on Deep Space Nine before the Cardassians pulled out, or while the Cardassians were there? Do you have any idea what was going on the station?
Not really.
Okay. I'm going to save that. If they haven't revealed it to you yet, sure. I'm going to save that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not super clear on that stuff, I guess, but it, like in the opening, I think you mentioned that, I don't know if you misspoke or if I have it wrong in my head, but did you say this was a Bajoran space station?
It is a Bajoran space station because it's in orbit of the planet Bajor.
Okay. But didn't, there was one time when, I forget if it was Sisko or he was talking with somebody, I think, about the construction of the station and how the office where we first met Major Kira was in the place where it was. It was raised because it was
Cardassian design and all that. Yeah.
Cardassian design.
Yeah.
And so like that's why I assumed it was a Cardassian space station.
Right. So put it this way. It was a space station designed and built I can't say it was built by the Cardassians. It was built by the Bajorans, like with their hands. They're the ones who physically made it, but they did it under slave labor, being controlled by.
Did the Bajorans build it for the Cardassians?
Yes. Yes.
Because the Cardassians were using it. That's why they used their designs.
Yeah, exactly. But they placed it over Bajor. So when the Cardassians pulled out of Bajor, they didn't take the station with them. So Bajor just claimed the station and then said, okay, hey, if we don't have somebody come in here and protect us from the Cardassians, they could stomp right back in here at any given notice. Hey, Federation, why don't you guys come establish a presence? Mm-hmm. Instead of coming on the planet, you go hang out up there on the space station and just basically just be a presence. That's all that they really wanted them to do.
Because they did mention that. They requested a Starfleet presence after the Cardassians left.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's where Sisko keeps saying, this is a Bajoran space station. I'm just here to administrate. We're just here to run the station. They're establishing Federation presence is all it is. Of course, we know later that he has a secret mission, or maybe not so secret, but an ulterior motive for being there.
Well, yeah, because I mean, they mentioned that something I wouldn't have guessed, and maybe you've told me, but I don't remember this stuff yet, that the Bajorans aren't part of the Federation yet.
Not yet. Yeah.
I kind of figure if we're going to stick around them for long, they probably will be, but
we'll find out.
Yep.
We'll find out. Yes. But no, at this point, they are not part of the Federation, which is part of the problem with some of those colonies. You like remember the colonies and stuff that have been having issues, like that Minos Corva that we heard about in Chain of Command.
Okay.
And even some of the Bajoran terrorist groups that we saw back in Ensign Row and those kinds of things. Anyway, we'll get to all of that in good time. In Ops, which is pretty much the bridge of the space station, it's time to meet Major Kira Nerys. She's the Bajoran attaché that will be the first officer here on the station. She's a bit fiery, outspoken, and doesn't believe that the Federation has any business in being here. She spent her whole life fighting to free Bajor from the Cardassians, and now that they're free, the new leaders just invite the Federation right on in. Humph. Sisko insists that they're only here to help, but yeah, the Cardassians, they said the same thing 60 years ago.
Okay, so I guess now is the time as good as any to try to sort some of this out, if you'll even answer things for me now. But
I will do my best.
So we have a commander who seems to be as high up as we go here. Mm-hmm. And then we have a major, which is a title we haven't really used in Star Trek up to this point.
Okay.
And so I don't know where that falls.
Okay.
But it sounds like they're making her his first officer.
Yes. All that's true. So, however, remember, she is a major in the Bajoran military.
Yeah.
So that is a Bajoran military.
It's this weird conglomeration of everybody.
Yes. But as far as hierarchy on the space station, Sisko is in command. Kira is the number one, is the Riker.
So I guess it'd be kind of a little bit weird to say there's a captain of a space station because they're not flying anywhere usually,
right?
Even though they do in this episode already. Mm-hmm.
Right.
But it's so
yeah, you can have a commander of a station that's not a captain.
Yeah. My question is that normal that like the highest ranking officer on a space station is a commander?
Yeah. You have to be a command level officer, a commander, lieutenant commander, whatever, to be in command, at least as far as Federation. And did they have this on Next Gen yet? I don't know. There's an episode of Next Generation that we're not going to watch that shows Troy taking the test to become a command officer.
Okay.
So that she can actually run the ship. Now we're not going to watch that particular episode. It's a good episode, actually. I quite enjoy it. You have to be a commander in order to run the ship. So like Data is a lieutenant commander. Riker is a commander. Geordi starts off as lieutenant junior grade and eventually transitions into being a lieutenant commander. And they just sort of do it one day.
Yeah.
You know, they never tell us that that's what happens. So, I mean, those are the guys who are allowed to be in command of the ship. Oh, Beverly. Beverly's a lieutenant commander as well. So she can be in control of the ship.
Sure.
But that's like a special designation. So yeah, a commander somewhere in your title has to be there to be the top dog, at least as far as the Federation goes, as far as we can tell.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Well, this bonding moment is interrupted by a security alert. Kira calls for a smooth-faced alien named Odo, who will meet her there. Apparently, there's been having a lot of break-ins lately. Flash to Section A-14, a young Ferengi and his accomplice are looting a store. They're quickly caught by Kira and Odo, who turns out to be a shapeshifter as we see an object fly right through his head. Apparently, he's head of security here on the station.
That was a surprise. That's something we haven't seen before in Star Trek. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, or I mean, if you just don't want to tell me, you don't want to tell me, but like, this is something brand new for Deep Space Nine. It's not something they've ever explored in Next Gen.
That is correct.
Okay.
That is correct. Unless you count Q as a shapeshifter, but I don't.
That's a different kind of, I mean. Yeah.
No, he is he is a biological being that shifts his shape, and
he's made of jello.
Goo, gelatinous substance. Actually is what it is.
A gelatinous cube.
It's a gelatinous deal. So just so you know about Odo, because I don't think they explore it on this particular episode. And we're going to bypass it. So it's just going to be a fact about him. He can only hold his shape for about 18 hours. And then he has to basically go to sleep or revert to his gelatinous state for a while before he can like that's how he re-energizes. And
wait. So when you say his shape, does that include like the humanoid form we typically see him in?
Yes. That like, so the humanoid form is not his natural form.
Well, yeah, that's kind of what I figured. Yeah,
his natural form is just this gelatinous goo.
Like when I just saw him, I mean, he did the head thing, but later on, obviously with the bag that he is, like it became a little bit more clear what he is or what he can do, but it's still, that's interesting that he, I guess, well, no, it's for the sake of the cameras and budget that they have him in humanoid form.
Right. But, and the whole face thing is basically, I don't know if they, see, this is where I know stuff and I just don't remember which one. The face looks like it does because he hasn't mastered how to replicate the human face yet. Like it's his closest approximation that he can go just because the human face is so hard to do.
Okay.
So that's why his face looks like it does. But he's a shapeshifter. And by the way, when he reverts to his gelatinous state, he has a bucket. That's what he goes into is a bucket. It's just a bucket.
Oh, that's fantastic. Other than the fact that, you know, you hope no one that doesn't understand what it is runs across it while he's in his bucket.
Right. Little like, Splatoon action there on the space station. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, if he gets starting sloshed around, I'm sure he'll poke up real quick and be like, hey, leave me alone. Anyway,
they're gonna have a lot of fun with that.
That yes. Now the young Ferengi turns out to be the nephew of Quark, who is the proprietor of the local gambling bar. These were the guys that we saw packing up the bar. They're leaving tomorrow and promise that the nephew is going to be severely punished. Sisko orders him to be taken to the brig anyway, but it turns out Sisko's only doing this so that he can coerce Quark into doing something that Sisko says is really important. And oh yeah, Captain Picard is still waiting.
Well, I like the way that Sisko phrased this. It's like, there's this old Ferengi legal tradition of plea bargaining.
Right. I'm
like, dude, that's an old human tradition. Sure, maybe the Ferengi use it too, but come on.
Right. Act two, Commander Sisko is finally meeting with Picard on board the Enterprise. Or at least we think it's the Enterprise. It might be over in Deep Space Nine somewhere. Picard introduces himself, but Sisko says that they already met, you know, at Wolf 359. This takes Picard back for a minute, but then it's down to business, even if it is a bit frosty at this point. The Bajorans need a lot of help in recovering from the Cardassian occupation. Picard would like to see them one day join the Federation, but there's a lot of work to be done first. He tells Sisko that it's his mission to do everything short of violating the Prime Directive to make them ready. It also turns out that Sisko objected to this assignment from Starfleet. It's pretty simple. He has a son that he's raising now, alone, and he also understands that Starfleet officers don't always get to and choose environments that are fit for families, which Sisko replies with, "That's why I'm looking at civilian life back on Earth, pal." Picard says he'll advise Starfleet to begin looking for a replacement, but until then, Sisko will emphatically do his job to the best of his ability, sir. Well, that was awkward.
Yeah. So this isn't the first time I really, or was it the first time? Okay. So this was the first time that I noticed it in this episode, and it comes up again later too, that some of these characters just really, and maybe it's because it's this mishmash of different crews and species and everything kind of thrown together. Because like I understand why Sisko is unhappy with Picard.
Right.
I understand why he doesn't have the same respect for Picard as the average person that meets him. Mm-hmm. But it still feels wrong from everything else that we've seen, right?
Right.
Like it's one thing to have your enemies hate you for or whatever. You know, mm-hmm. the Cardassians are upset with you. Fine. Right. That's one thing. The Romulans are upset with you. Fine. Whatever. But to have someone sitting across the table from you in a Starfleet uniform and not liking Picard of all people.
Right.
And I mean, okay, you could go back and make the argument that, well, he was their enemy at one point, mm-hmm. and that's why he's upset with him. Right. But it just feels strange from the reactions we see from everybody else when they meet Picard. Like, usually people are like super excited to meet Picard, and it's like, oh, I've heard
he's the captain of the flagship, right?
Yeah, the captain of the Enterprise. Like, let's sit down, let's have dinner. Mm-hmm. Like, okay. But it's like, yeah, now we see Sisko, and he's like, yeah, this is the last person I want to be talking to. I want to get out of this room as soon as possible.
Yeah.
And like he consistently like interrupts Picard, mm-hmm. and gives him this, you know, attitude.
Yeah.
And like, wow. And like we see a little bit of this later too, not with Picard or anything, but I just noted it because it felt so strange from the interactions between officers that we are used to seeing, mm-hmm. on the Enterprise. And this came later when Odo wants to come along on the mission. Mm-hmm. And like everybody, I think Kier was in charge at that point because Sisko was absent. But like Kier's like, no, you got to stay here and protect the ship. And like, he's not putting up with it. And like, I can't picture, you know, Worf basically talking down to everybody and saying, no, I'm coming along. That's the final word. Mm-hmm. And that's basically what we see Odo do. And I'm like,
right,
that feels wrong. But I think more than anything just feels different from what we're used to here.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if that's going to be a regular thing going into this series, or if it's just kind of everybody still getting used to each other, mm-hmm. and creating, for lack of a better phrase, that chain of command.
I want you to now put yourself into the position of Star Trek fans, particularly those who had been fans since the original series, mm-hmm. right? And they went through all those reruns through the 70s. They went through the movies in the early 80s. They've been through Next Generation. Maybe they finally have accepted Next Generation. And all of a sudden, we're now seeing all this fighting. This is not the Starfleet way. This is not the Star Trek way. What is this new thing that is here claiming to be Star Trek? This isn't real Star Trek. This Roddenberry would be rolling over in his grave. You see what happens when Roddenberry passes away and he's no longer in control? We now have conflict and people, oh my. Enter into Star Trek fandom 201, Matt. This is it. And every time we have a new iteration of Star Trek, this begins again.
Mm-hmm. There's going to be some change that people don't like.
And here at Beam Me Up, we love all Star Trek. It's all fine and it's all canon and we're going to embrace it all.
Oh yeah.
Even if it's different. I'm just putting that out there because anyway.
This isn't the end.
This is not the end. No, this is where we start. And yeah, Odo says it a little bit different. Speaking of Odo, let's jump back into this. Back on the station, Sisko has changed into his new uniform. Huh? Did you notice? He's meeting with Quark and Odo, but he's not going to let Quark leave the station. He needs Quark to be a community leader to get the other shop owners to stay. Quark literally laughs in his face. But that's when Sisko pulls the nephew card. We can get him out of jail if you stay. And Odo has a newfound appreciation for Sisko.
Does he?
Oh, yeah.
Appreciation feels like a strong word.
Well, what's he say? He literally, I think he says, you know, I didn't think I would like him or something of that nature.
Yeah, I guess he did say something like that.
Right. But he does in that gravelly Odo. You know, Quark, I didn't think I was going to like. The new uniform, the station uniform. Did you note it at all?
I don't know that I noted a change. No.
No. So the new uniform, it actually looks very much like the Starfleet cadet uniform we saw back in the first duty. It's black from here down. And there's just the shoulders are the colors.
I noticed that later in the episode.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I don't know that I noticed the change per se, but I noticed it later in the episode. I'm like, has it always been like that? Like, I tried to picture what like the old uniforms look like, or, you know, next gen uniforms. uniforms, or like, I should have just looked up pictures probably, but right. I didn't even think about just rewinding to the beginning of this episode.
there's the explanation for this is the next generation uniform, where it's the color is the main color, and then it has the black, you know, to highlight it, I guess, or whatever, mm-hmm. low light it. Those are the uniforms that you use on ships. These are the uniforms you use in stationary places, star bases, a space station, Starfleet Command, various things like that. It's just this black deal, sure. with the V-neck. Now eventually that's going to overtake and become the new uniform across the all of Starfleet. The other mm-hmm. explanation is that Starfleet is now in the midst of changing their uniform. And instead of just saying, hey, everybody replicate new uniforms, it's like they do it as new places come online. So like, this is a new space station. So the space station gets the new uniforms. If there's a new ship will get the new uniforms, whereas everybody else is still using the old uniforms. I think that one holds a little more consistent. Yeah.
I can see this from like a new retail store or something, right? Mm-hmm. A retail chain. If Walmart builds a new store, they're not going to build it with all the old technology. They mm-hmm. put the new technology in right away, mm-hmm. and then over time we'll retrofit the old stores.
Right. Except they have replicators, which can make the new uniforms like that. Throw the old ones in, go back to Adams, and then make the new uniforms. I don't understand why they just don't tell everybody to change, but
testing them.
Oh, okay. Sure.
Make sure people approve.
But so if you do go back and watch this episode, and you should, it starts with Sisko in the ship uniform. And when he first arrives on the station, he's in the ship uniform, but O'Brien is in the black jumpsuit. But later in the episode, when O'Brien's back on the Enterprise, kind of doing his little farewell walk, he's back in his ship uniform. And then when he comes back to the station, he goes back. So there really is very much a switch. And Picard is still in his regular uniform. Later on, as Starfleet captains or ship people come onto the space station, you will note that they are ship people because they have the other uniform. Yeah. Whereas the station people, the Starfleet people, are people that come from Starfleet headquarters, they're going to be in the new uniform. So
sure.
Anyway, in other words, it's a new show, so they're getting new uniforms. Yep. They're getting new costumes. That's really what's going on. All right, back on the promenade, Kira still doesn't like or even trust Sisko. That notwithstanding, Sisko tells Kira about his conversation with Quark. Kira thinks that this provisional government's going to be gone within a week, and so will the Federation, and Bajor is going to devolve into civil war. The only one who can prevent it is Kai Opaka. She's basically the Bajoran space pope, and she lives in seclusion. That's when the Vedic, or the Pryler, from before tells Sisko, "Commander, it's time. The prophets await you."
I'm telling you, Indiana Jones. All I see.
Down on Bajor somewhere, Sisko is walking around a temple when he is greeted by Kai Opaka. She asks about his paw, his life force, or the force, or whatever you want to call it. She grabs his ear and says, "You know, it's ironic that he who doesn't wish to be among us is to be the emissary," whatever that means. The Kai brings Sisko further into the temple. She's not interested in what Sisko has to say. She has other things on her mind. She says that Sisko needs to give himself something, and then she opens up a box to reveal a shiny thingy called the Tear of the Prophet, and she leaves.
Appreciate the secret staircase below the pond.
Right. That she has the remote clicker in her vest. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Right. I like that. But yeah, the Tear of the Prophet. Uh-huh. Go figure.
Uh-huh. Can we talk about the grabby ear thing?
That's weird.
She grabs his ear. Especially where they have that earring on the one side. So by the way, just a little note, Ensign Ro, I think it's Ensign Ro. Ensign Ro wears her earring on the wrong ear. Okay.
They're figuring things out.
Do what? Yes. But later on, like, kind of when asked about like, why does she wear it on the wrong ear? She's like, "Well, I didn't really, Ensign Ro wasn't really that religious of a person. She wore the earring to honor her people and her ancestors, but she also didn't like when they grabbed her ear. So she put the earring on the other ear to stop them from grabbing her ear." Doing that, like, that was Michelle Forbes's like answer for why, like, talk about sure. a retcon, right? But yeah, the grabby ear, and I'm gonna feel your life force, your paw. By the way, the paw, actually, I think it was the Pog, was the name of the ship that Riker did his yep. little exchange service on. They'll bring back the name again.
That's honestly what I thought of when they first said it.
Is it like, really? You made that connection?
Yes.
I got to tell you, when we did that episode, I'm listening to that, and I'd never picked up on it before, and I went, "They just call this the paw? This is the paw?"
Yeah, what? I think they pronounce it slightly differently, but I'm pretty sure, I always have subtitles on so I can take my notes properly. I'm pretty sure they spell it the same.
Yeah, pretty much.
And so I was correct. Like you did say that's the Klingon ship, right?
Yeah, that was the Klingon ship that Riker did his little exchange thing with.
Yeah, that's why I was super confused when I'm like, wait, are they involved in Klingons now? Like, what is going on? Right. I didn't know that Pog meant life force.
Right.
Why didn't tell us that? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Ironic, he who doesn't wish to be among us is to be the emissary. We'll talk about that later. Suddenly, Sisko is whisked away to a beach somewhere. It's not long before he realizes that he's reliving a memory. This particular memory is when he first met Jennifer, his wife, and there she is right in front of him. Sisko is excited, to say the least. Ow! He's loving every minute of this. Ow! And he invites her to dinner. Promising to make his father's famous stew. And just as she says yes, the shiny thing appears and Ben is back in the temple cave. The Kai says that 9 of these orbs have appeared over the skies over the last 100,000 years or 10,000 years. They've shaped the Bajoran religion and culture, and the Cardassians have 8 of them. They're trying to unlock their power, but we can't let that happen. She tells Sisko that he must find the celestial temple, and she gives him the last orb. It's his destiny. Only then can she unite her people.
Yeah, so Sisko's destiny, like that, just the fact that they brought this up, like when you start talking destiny, this does not feel like this is going to be done in one episode,
right?
And so like I mean, don't know what to think of at this point. It's like, is this going to be, are you introducing something that's bigger than this, or is this really just the plot for this episode?
Yes. Yes. Act 3. Ben is doing that creepy dad thing where he's just watching his kids sleep when suddenly he's interrupted by Kira calling him to the promenade. It turns out that Quark has unpacked and reopened his bar, and it is packed. No social distancing happening here. Ben sits down at the bar and Quark is like, hey dude, I've reopened. Can you please go get my nephew out of jail now?
So does Quark's bar have a better name than Quark's bar?
Nope, it's just Quark's.
Is it actually called Quark's?
Quark's bar, yeah. Quark. Okay. Quark's bar, whatever. Sure. Huh. So it's the bar. There's the gambling that has there. They also have the Hollow Suites.
Okay.
There. It's the Hollow Deck, but they call them Hollow Suites because it's not a deck, right?
Rooms you rent by the hour?
Rooms you can rent by the hour. And I will leave it to your imagination, the types of programs that people run out there on the frontier.
That's why I phrased it as I did.
And whatever you're imagining is exactly what it is. And it's kind of a little... Anyway, later on, the Enterprise is getting ready to leave because this isn't their show. They're offloading a few runabouts, the new shuttle pods we're going to use on Deep Space Nine, and the medical and science officer are finally arriving. Dr. Bashir is a bright-eyed and bushy-tailed young officer, and he's got the libido to rival Kirk and Riker combined. But the new science officer is a very pretty 28-year-old Trill named Jadzia Dax. Not only is she a Trill, she's a joined Trill, meaning that she has a 300-year-old symbiote living inside of her that allows her to share the memories of all the other hosts who have come before her. It also turns out that Sisko and Dax's last host were very good friends, and the Dax symbiote has carried that friendship through to Jadzia. Sisko takes Jadzia to the science lab where he shows her the orb to get her to start working on figuring out what is going on with this thing. She says that she was glad to hear that he took this assignment, and he says, hey, it's good to see you too, old man. Knowing smiles between the two.
Yeah, this is all sorts of weird and creepy. But thankfully, your explanation of it here, I feel, was much clearer than what was actually in the show.
Right. Okay.
It answered a lot of my questions.
Okay.
Because they just kept like hinting at stuff. It's like, you're a Trill. Oh, you're a joint species. You have a slug inside of you. Oh, okay. You had a different form, old man. What? Oh, now we're going to show you this slug transplant.
Right.
Oh, what? I like putting all that together with your explanation and those pictures in mind. It makes sense now.
Right. Remember what I said earlier about this show really is so much better on the rewatch when you know what's going on?
Sure. I'm feeling they explain the better, explored a little bit more. I mean, if she's a main member of the crew here, like there'll probably be an episode or two about her.
Yeah.
So like,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we're going to learn a few things and maybe some things are going to happen. Like,
there's an episode, Matt, I don't mind telling you, because it's probably at best going to be an extra viewing for us.
Does someone steal her slug?
Yes, there is that episode too. There is that episode too. And if the slug comes out, she dies.
Oh.
Yes. She can't just lose the slug. Like, they're now dependent upon each other to live.
Well, yeah, I guess I kind of...
And if the slug doesn't have a host, the slug dies. And
well,
Krill society is protect the slug.
Sure, but like... I kind of got that, like, when they took it out of the old man, like, uh-huh. He died. Uh-huh. They kind of made that clear. But how was she living then? Did she have an old slug that they replaced, or?
No. So, okay.
You get a slug on your 21st birthday?
No. Actually, okay, so good question. And I'll just tell you about it because we're going to skip the episodes that really deal with the Trills. Which, by the way, we've met some Trills in Next Generation, but they've never been fully explored. Here's the basic deal. You, on the planet Trill, you have two essential beings that grew up side by side, evolved side by side. One are the humanoid forms, and the second are the slugs. The slugs can live for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. They just need a host to survive, right? And they can carry the memories forward.
They need an Egger suit.
Right. They need an Egger suit. Exactly. But they form a true symbiotic relationship with the host. Now, the Trill humanoids, there's tons and tons and tons and tons of those people. There's very few of the actual slugs. So in order to become somebody who is joined with one of the slugs in their society, you have to go through some rigorous training, rigorous testing, all this. Like, it's very hard to get a slug. It's a very prestigious thing to have, to be a joined Trill. There's tons of Trills out there who are not joined, that are just walking around. They're normal, ordinary, everyday people. So, and when they die, they die.
Are both the humanoids and the slugs considered Trills?
Yes. Yes, they are both.
Okay.
Yeah. Or at least they're of the same world. Let's put it that way.
I don't know if
there's another name for the slug. They're all Trills as far as I know.
Using it basically like Earthlings or Martian.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, we don't call a monkey an Earthling.
Exactly.
Necessarily.
Exactly.
So yeah. It's yeah.
Yeah. But you know, the two beings are, you know, they've evolved together and you know, they work together. So Jadzia received this one. The previous host was an old man. That old man, his name was Curzon. So he would have been Curzon Dax. Dax is the name of the symbiote. Jadzia is the name of the host. So together they make up Jadzia Dax. Now they will use the name Jadzia Dax or Jadzia Dax interchangeably to refer to her.
Well, like I said, in the credits, she's listed as Lieutenant Dax.
Right, right.
Like, I didn't get Jadzia until this point in the episode.
Exactly. So technically.
But they did mention Curzon.
You're right. Technically, Jadzia is the name of the host. Dax is the name of the symbiote.
Makes sense.
And so, like, previously, Curzon was the previous host, Curzon Dax. And they'll explore that. There's a really cool episode, though, I don't mind telling you, Matt. We'll do this as an extra viewing, where Jadzia goes through a ritual where she gets to meet all of her previous hosts.
But they're dead.
Yeah, it's sci-fi. They can make that work. But what happens is those consciousness get transferred into her best friends who volunteer. And of course, all of her best friends are the main cast of the show. So we see the cast, like, acting very differently than they, like, acting as their previous hosts. Sure. It's a very cool episode. It's a very cool look into Jadzia. But yeah, she walks this line, and it's a very tricky writing thing. And it's very cool between she's 28 years old, but she's also 328 years old at the same time. And
that's why they made that joke.
Right. She has the memories of, I think she is the seventh.
That joke makes so much more sense once you explained how the Trills work.
Oh, you mean the old man where he calls her old man? Is that what you're talking about?
No, they make the joke about it. Like she says, I'm only 28, and
Cisco
mentioned more like 328.
Right. exactly. Cause I think it's Jadzia is the seventh host for the Dax symbiote.
Fair enough.
So, you know, so there's all those, and she has the memories of all those who have gone before.
It's a little bit, it reminds me a little bit of, now I'm going to forget if this was an extra viewing we did or if it was in the main line, The Inner Light.
Yeah, that was the main show. That was absolutely a main show.
Yeah. But like how Picard basically like extended his life by like 45 years. Mm-hmm.
And he has the memories of that other person. He carries them back with him.
Exactly. Yeah. That's kind of what I'm thinking of here.
Yeah. That's pretty much what happens here. And the thing for Trills is save the life of the symbiote. The life of the symbiote is what matters because the symbiote can move forward. The host will come and go.
The host can be replaced.
Exactly. You're also, by the way, you're not supposed to carry relationships from one host into the next host as a symbiote. The fact that she happens to be meeting up with an old friend of her of Curzon's is never fully explained why that's okay, but they're really not supposed to bring forward friendships.
Sure.
From one, for obvious reasons, which you can imagine the complications that might occur from the point of the Trill is to go experience new life and new situations and new things. And you can't do that by continuing clinging to the old. So yeah. So by the way, Jadzia is going to be our science officer, just in case that wasn't clear. She is our science officer and our number two. So the order of rank is going to go Sisko, Kira, Jadzia.
Interesting.
And she's the science officer. Spock was the science officer on the original series. Mm-hmm. Data was the science officer, one of the operations officers on Next Generation, although he wore yellow, not blue, but still.
So this is going to be they really tried to shake things up here.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
So like our top trio.
Yeah.
It not only does it have two women, but the quote unquote captain or commander in this case, as you already mentioned, is black.
Yeah.
This is all like first.
Welcome to Starfleet. Welcome to Star Trek, Matt. And this is why the whole world needs to sit down and watch Star Trek. And by the way, all of these people are given full authority to be where they are. Nobody has to be justified as far as why they're there. They've all earned spot and earned their rank. So
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. Well, why don't we continue? You already mentioned that Jadzia gets one of those flashy memory things where we see her receiving her symbiote from the old man, which makes that whole reference make sense. Down in the medical office, one of my favorite scenes, Kira is showing Bashir around. Everything is disheveled and broken, and Bashir loves it. He goes on and on about this being the frontier land and becoming a hero and having his pick of any posting that he wanted. And Kira is only slightly miffed. This wilderness, as he calls it, is her home. And now we get to watch Bashir try to pull that foot out of his mouth. I love Bashir.
Yeah, I have a feeling he's going to be a little bit of a... I don't know how to describe him.
He's just a young guy. I don't mind telling you, Bashir will probably be the single character who goes through the most growth outside of Jake, because Jake explodes over the course of the season. But he's a kid in puberty.
I guess the best way to put it is Bashir is going to be more Bones and less Crusher.
It's hard to say, because Bashir really is kind of his own thing. Bashir is his own thing. He really is.
Just the initial vibe that I get from him, though. It's not as serious as Crusher.
That is true. That is true. But Bashir also doesn't have his own kid that he's responsible for. He's not the head of it. He's not going to be the head of Starfleet. He's not been a doctor very long. He just graduated, right?
Yeah.
So, he's that guy who, you know, he knows everything. And he was top of his class, and now he's out at his first job. That's essentially who Bashir is. Mm-hmm. And he's looking for adventure. He got out of the small town wherever he came from, and he's out looking for adventure. So, oh, by the way, he's really smart too. Did you catch that?
Aren't they all?
Yeah. He would have been valedictorian in his class, except he made one teeny tiny little mistake. So he's super smart. Anyway, back on the Enterprise, Miles O'Brien is taking one last walk around the ship. He tries to avoid Captain Picard, but just as he's about to transport away, Picard shows up. They have a heartfelt and meaningful goodbye as Miles Edward O'Brien makes his transfer to Deep Space Nine complete, and with Captain Picard himself energizing the beam. And with that, the Enterprise flies away. Hey, don't we usually go with them when they do that?
Aw. That's all I have to say about this scene.
Yeah.
Aw.
I'm really glad they put this one in.
Although I do appreciate that O'Brien has a favorite transporter room.
Transporter room 3, sir.
Yes.
Exactly. That's one of those little like Star Trek trivia things that you just, you know. Yeah. Anyway,
I do kind of wonder when he, towards the end of this episode, when he's in on the space station. I don't think it's a transporter. What is he referencing then? There was something where like he says, you can find me in like bay C or something like that, or like something C,
upper pylon C.
Sure.
Yeah. So you remember, you know, Deep Space Nine has those six tendrils, right? There's upper and lower. Those are the pylons. It's where the ships dock. That's where the big ships dock, and the ring that goes around the outside of Deep Space Nine design can actually fit much smaller ships all around it. So like this is a space station where a lot of ships can dock all at the same time.
Yeah.
But the really big ones, like a galaxy class starship, have to go up to the pylons.
Okay. So it just made me wonder though, if, you know, okay, they don't number theirs are lettered and ABC 1, 2, 3. Uh-huh. You went to the third one.
There you go. Oh, interesting. Or not. Oh, that's funny. It's his favorite pylon, upper mm-hmm. pylon C.
Yep.
There you go. I am glad they put this scene in though. Like this would have been weird if it was just look, O'Brien got transferred. And they're like, this one I think made it feel legit to me.
Yeah.
It made it legitimized. Like it wasn't just hey, they're just pulling somebody over, which is what they're doing, but it gave it an in universe. Like we see what happens with that on an in universe way.
Yeah. I think it was their opportunity to show you, you know, people come and go from shifts. People mm-hmm. change occupations, change careers, change mm-hmm. whatever, get promotions, demotions, just, you know, change location, whatever. And this is their opportunity to actually show how that might look.
It's
like you always talk about, like there's other families on board, but we don't usually see what they're doing, what they're mm-hmm. up to. Mm-hmm. And so this is just one of those instances when, yes, this is something that happens. Mm-hmm.
And speaking of family, by the way, just so you remember, I don't know if you remember episodes that we skipped, Miles has a wife whose name is Keiko. Yep. And
she was in this one.
She was, Keiko was in this one. Really? Keiko was in this one?
She was mentioned in this one for sure. Uh-huh. I don't know if she was actually in it. There was one lady that O'Brien was talking to, like uh-huh. that seemed to be in some like private quarters that I thought maybe could have been here, but I think we just got the back of her head, so I don't know if it was her. Hmm.
Yeah, because I'm pretty sure she didn't make her appearance till the next episode. Unless you watched,
she was mentioned for sure.
She definitely was mentioned for sure because she is an established character on Star Trek as a whole. As is their daughter Molly, who was birthed in an elevator by Worf.
Okay,
just a little.
I think
I've mentioned that once before. Yeah.
But I don't remember that.
So the family dynamic, you know, we'll be following up on that and we'll have our conversation about the Miles and Keiko relationship as well. Now is not that time. Time for Act 4. A Cardassian ship is coincidentally approaching the station just as the Enterprise left. Gul Dukat, the former commander of the station and head of the occupation force, is coming to say hi. Dukat tries to schmooze Sisko, but he gets to it pretty quick. He knows that Sisko went to see Opaka and brought back one of those orbs, and he wants that orb. Sisko sees right through all this pretense and denies knowing anything about an orb. No matter then, he'll stay close by, you know, just in case he changes his mind. And in the meantime, some of Dukat's men will, quote unquote, enjoy the hospitality of the promenade. What could go wrong, Matt?
Uh-huh. Well, I want an episode focused on a day in the life of the Cardassian intelligence officer.
Okay.
Because they are always on top, like they have top-notch intelligence all the time. Uh-huh. Like every time they come over to the Enterprise, every time they come over to Deep Space Nine, mm-hmm. it's like, blah, 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 blah. Hey, by the way, I know exactly all the secret plans you've been doing. Let's get down to business.
Uh-huh. You might get that sooner rather than later, Matt. Just saying. Anyway. Maybe the next time. Sisko goes to see Dax. She's collected a bunch of information, and she believes she has possibly found this celestial temple thing in something called the Denarius Belt. Sort of sounds like a Bermuda Triangle at first, with talk of heavens opening up and swallowing ships, but this is also where a bunch of the orbs have been found. So, of course, Sisko wants to go take a look. Undetected by the Cardassians, I might add. So, plot. Scene about the plot. I like that we're getting to we've met people now, so now mm-hmm. we can get into the story of what's happening.
Well, yeah, it's the second half of the episode. Like,
yeah. We got to start moving here, people.
The first sort of few, like, mm-hmm. acts, super long.
Yeah.
Like, sure. I'm like, did you really not put commercials in here? Right. Or what? Like, right. But then, and like, get in the second half, and just like they start flying. Yeah,
And then when we get to the prophets, we'll have a whole conversation with that. Down in Quarks, everyone's having a good time. Lots of gambling. The Cardassians are winning a lot. That is until Kira comes in to shut it down for some weird reason. Quark is embarrassed, miffed, and says that he'll clear it up. But in the meantime, he gives the Cardassians a bag to put their winnings into, which they immediately take to their ship. But wait for it. That bag was really Odo the shapeshifter, who's up to who's getting up to some shenanigans over at the Cardassian ship. And then he blinds those ships to the runabout that is about to leave. As he's finished, O'Brien tries to bring Odo back, but O'Brien can't figure out how to use the Cardassian transporter until he just kicks it and Odo comes back.
That's the thing. He does know how to use it. He knows right. He's doing it right. It's just this ship. It's mm-hmm. space station. I'm going to do that all the time. I'm going to call it a ship.
It's all right.
It's just so beat up uh-huh. that things aren't quite working properly. There's loose connections all over the place. And so
kick it.
Yeah. Kick it.
Oh, listening to O'Brien have a conversation with the computer is also quite hilarious.
It's frustrating.
It is.
Also, Constable uh-huh. Odo.
Constable Odo. Yes.
They're really trying to like change things here. It's uh-huh. not like security officer. Mm-hmm. No, that's what he is, what he's doing. Uh-huh. But no, constable.
He's the constable.
And I guess once again, it kind of puts into perspective. It's like, this is more like a city.
Well, okay. So I'm glad you say that. So let's talk about that just for a second, because I think it'll pull all this stuff together as far as a way to think about Deep Space Nine. When Star Trek, and I mean the original Star Trek, was first sold to the network, Gene Roddenberry pitched it as Wagon Train to the Stars. Now, Wagon Train was apparently a show about the West where they were traveling a bunch way back in the day in the Old West. And they said, let's make it Wagon Train to the Stars. It really was made the ideas as a Western where they go off and explore all this new territory. Whereas Deep Space Nine was going, well, if Star Trek is Wagon Train to the Stars, Deep Space Nine is going to be that ghost town that's just out in the middle of nowhere. That's a frontier town. So like as Bashir comes in, he's, this is frontier medicine, all that kind of stuff. Like that's how this one was sold. So you have the sheriff of the town or the constable. You've got the bar.
Well, that's the thing. If they use sheriff, it'd make more sense in that respect. Right. Like constable is a very, in my mind, British word. Mm-hmm. Like we don't have constables in America.
We do.
They have constables in Britain.
No, we have constables here.
Not where I live.
I bet you do. Go look it up. I'll bet you do. Constables, you know what? Where I'm from, what constables do they typically are the people who serve legal documents to people. It's an elected position as a constable. They don't really have like arresting powers and stuff like that, but they serve people. But anyway, check it out and see if it's not really a thing. And hey, if it is for you guys out there, I'm just curious, what does a constable do in your town? But here he's basically the sheriff. You've got the bar or the spittoon, not the spittoon, what is it? The saloon.
You've got a spittoon.
You've got the new guy who's just come into town. You've got the bad guy out there, and you know, you got the horses that they all run around on, or the runabouts in this case. Speaking of runabouts, Act 5, the runabout is arriving at those coordinates in the Denorius Belt. There's some sciencey stuff, and hey, what do you do? Or hey, what do you know? The heavens really did open up and swallow the ship. Deep Space Nine doesn't seem to have them on sensors anymore, and the runabout can't make out what's going on either. And before you know it, the heavens open back up and spit out the ship again. But wait for it. They're now 70,000 light years from Bajor in the Gamma Quadrant. Take them about 70 years to get home if they were to turn around and head back. They've just found the first stable wormhole known to exist. That's cool. Well, let's turn around and head home real quick. Only this time on the way through, they lose their engines and they wind up landing on an asteroid or something that's actually inside the wormhole. It has an atmosphere. It's capable of supporting life. That's also weird. Ben and Jadzia head out to see what's up, but each one of them has a different experience of what's going on. Jadzia sees an idyllic, beautiful meadow, and all Sisko can see is cliff and rocks and a storm, and oh yeah, there's a floating orby thing right there over your head. Just then, the orb blasts them both, sucks up Dax, the ground fissures and opens up, and Ben gets drawn into, well, limbo.
Pretty good description for it.
There you go.
Yes. Big action sequence. First stable wormhole is the big note to come out of that one, though. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Now that you mentioned that it's like in the opening.
Uh-huh.
Like I, by the end of this episode, I figured it was going to be a pretty major thing for this series.
Yeah.
But now that you mentioned that it's like in not only did they exclude it from the intro initially, mm-hmm. but then put it in, it's like, okay, it's going to be a big thing.
Yeah. Yeah. This wormhole becomes the crux of really the series and
why Deep Space Nine is important. The final captain's log at the end of this is the life forms inside agree to allow safe passage to any ship through the mm-hmm. wormhole. I'm like, okay. Mm-hmm. That's going to be important.
Yeah. And I mean, Kira even says at one point, she's like, that's going to put Bajor on the map. We have to stake a claim. Like that's going to become a thing here. You know, so it's not just we're not just on a space station anymore. This is something important. Let's keep moving. Mm-hmm. While that's happening, the orb that ate Dax heads out of the wormhole back to DS9 and drops off Dax. All right. Now it gets really weird. Sisko is starting to see images of people that he knows, both in his current and his former life. However, these people people are not the ones that he actually knows. He figures out that this is a new alien life form. He begins to tell them about himself. Apparently, they're non-corporeal beings, and they don't understand the concept of time. Speaking of which, this is going to take some time to explain.
Yeah, I don't even want to try to think about how I would explain time to someone.
I'm telling you, Matt, time is a sphere where all points exist at all times. And that's where these guys live.
Yeah.
There is no beginning and end and middle. It all time just is not there.
Linear.
Time is not linear. I love this.
Fair
it
enough.
Might be fair to say, Matt, and I think this is 100% true. We've talked on this show about my personal idea and understanding of time and why, while I believe time travel is very possible, that it's impossible to change time because of it being a closed system, it very well may have been shaped. I would say it was absolutely shaped by the wormhole aliens from Deep Space Nine.
Okay.
Like kind of starting to see it through those eyes of non-linear time and how it is experienced. Mm-hmm. The other thing, and I was just having this conversation with somebody the other day, remember a wormhole is a tear through the fabric of space and time, not just space. So the idea that aliens living inside of a tear that is within the fabric of space and time means they live outside of space and time.
Yeah.
Gives it a whole new thing as well.
You
know, especially as we're meeting these beings that have become gods to the people of Bajor, which is interesting to see how they treat the quote unquote prophets or the wormhole aliens or however that works. Anyway.
So I do need to clarify something though.
Yes.
Because this scene actually kind of confused it a little bit more for me.
Sure.
These things they keep referring to as the orbs.
Uh-huh.
The orbs aren't the life forms, right?
No.
Because they're non-corporeal.
Right.
So like, it seemed really weird when the orb returned to Dax.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's what made me think like, oh, they, you know, sent her, they brought her back to the ship, then, you know, went back to their wormhole or something like, but that's not really what happened. But then it's like, so do they just have an unlimited supply of these orbs? Like they only thought there were 10, but or 9 or whatever, but it's now it's like they can just send them out whenever they want.
That would actually be the 10th orb, right? That we just saw, right? So I don't know how many orbs the wormhole aliens have.
Or if they can just create them.
But the idea of these orbs, it's almost like a video game, Matt, where like each orb does something different. Like there's the orb of time and there's the orb of prophecy and there's the orb of prosperity and there's the orb of like whatever they all do. And I don't think that we ever, let me tell you what's not going to happen. Sisko's not going to go on a mission to find and unite all of the orbs in an ultimate bid to defeat Gul Dukat at the end of the series. That's not what's going to happen. This is not, we're not collecting Horcruxes here. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But that would be an interesting, what happens if you unite the orbs?
That the use of the word orb though, for these things does bother me to some extent.
Cause it's not an orb.
Yeah. They're not round.
Right.
Like, it's not an orb. It's like, I mean, almost more like kind of hourglass shaped, I think, from my memory.
Yeah. Yeah. That's about right.
It's like, what?
I know.
What? And really? Couldn't come up with a better word than orb?
Yeah. You're right. You're not wrong. You're not wrong.
Okay. I'm glad I'm not alone.
Well, we're going to get back to those wormhole aliens here in just a minute. But for now, back on the station, the crew is preparing to launch a rescue mission. This wormhole is not a natural phenomenon. It was probably created by the same aliens that created these orbs. Not only that, the Cardassians are headed for that Denorius belt. Kira realizes that the wormhole might reshape this entire sector of the quadrant, and she has a bright idea. Let's move the station to the mouth of the wormhole. Bajor needs to stake this claim. They figure out how to make it happen and will contact Starfleet to get the Enterprise to come back, only they're pretty far away. That said, Kira, Dax, and Bashir head out on a runabout. And oh yeah, Odo is coming too. It just so happens that he was found in the Denorius belt as well. He doesn't know who he is or where he's from, and this is a chance to find out those answers.
I was already kind of interested in Odo. Now I'm even more so. Like, give me that backstory. Let him find out more about where he comes from and if there are more of him or if he's the only one.
Hold on to that thought. Act 6, back in the wormhole, Sisko is still talking to the non-corporeal aliens. They debate destroying Sisko. Sisko insists he hasn't come to hurt anyone. He's there representing the people that they've contacted. He's not their enemy, and he wants to prove it. He'll allow them to probe his memories of the past. But, oh yeah, they have no concept of linear time either. He's going to keep working on this. I always find it interesting that he says, I'm representing the people that you have chosen to contact, and they're kind of like, we contacted people? What do you mean?
Yeah.
What are you talking? Anyway, back on Deep Space Nine, O'Brien is having a lovely conversation with the computer. There's a lot of techno babble, but O'Brien works like I do when I'm running a gig and manages to get the station moving. He and the computer are going to need to have a little chat after this.
Yeah, that's a very interesting part. I love that. This computer is not like it's not quite as subservient as the Starfleet computers, Federation right. computers. It's like it has attitude and a little bit of, you know, it's almost feels like a little more advanced AI. Uh-huh. Instead of telling you up front that I can't do this because of security protocol, it's like, no, I'm not going to do that. Well, why aren't you going to do that? Oh, because it'll break this rule. I'm like, well, why didn't you just say that in the first place, computer? Come on.
Right.
I think these interactions could be something good, but if I'm being honest, this episode, they were a little bit just kind of frustrating and more frustrating and almost annoying than funny, but I think they'll figure it out.
You hope so. Hey, a quick flash to the runabout. Kira and Odo are having a conversation with Dukat. Basically, the Cardassians are going to try to get these wormhole aliens, out of these wormhole aliens, whatever they can. Maybe they won't be so hostile to us, Dukat says. Well, we'll see about that. Back in the wormhole, the aliens continue to explore Ben's life, starting with Jennifer. She is a part of his existence. Sisko tries to explain the idea that she's now dead, but they don't really comprehend that idea either. Sisko tries to tell him about the nature of a linear existence, how each day shapes all the days that come after it. This particular memory is the one where Ben and Jennifer decided to start a family. It's a very sweet scene. The wormhole alien is trying to figure out what a kiss is, but Ben is clearly getting emotional at watching himself and the love of his life have a discussion. This is a pleasurable thing, this kiss. Humans like to have good feelings and happiness. But now the wormhole aliens have a question. They flash Ben back to the day that Jennifer died and they say, so why do you exist here? You exist in this unpleasurable experience. Sisko doesn't want to be here, but the aliens insist that he exists here. While Ben is trying to figure out what they mean, the Cardassians have arrived and are traveling through the wormhole to the Gamma Quadrant. The aliens get mad and seal off the wormhole.
Stupid Cardassians.
Ruh-roh, Rorge. Yeah. He exists here. Let's get to the end of that because I want to have that conversation because this, I think, is certainly the Star Trek message of the premiere episode.
Yep.
Act 7, back in the wormhole, the aliens explain that every time a ship passes through, it disrupts their existence. They insist that this kind of behavior has no regards for the consequences of their actions. Ben counters saying, no, that's not so. Even though we don't know the outcome of our actions before we take them, we have to let past experience guide us. We accept beforehand the consequences of our actions before we ever take them. He uses the example of Jennifer and himself. The experiences of their lives prepared them for that day on the beach when they would meet and help them see that they had a future together. And when they got married, they accepted any consequences that would come from that act, including having Jake. The wormhole aliens are starting to understand, but there's also this adversarial thing that they keep picking up on. Ben uses the experience of baseball to say, no, this is fun. It's a competition. But before a game, nobody knows what the outcome will be. That's what makes it fun. With each pitch, many different things could happen. Each one together takes the shape of a game. If we knew ahead of time what was going to happen, the game wouldn't even be worth playing. The wormhole aliens start to get it, but now we get to a conversation about the nature of humanity. We value the ignorance of the future. It's discovering that future that drives us. We are explorers. Each question doesn't necessarily lead to answers, but it leads to new questions. This is why Ben is here, to meet them, to learn from them, to coexist with them, not to conquer them. But if all this is true, then why do you exist here? And we flash back to the Saratoga and the day that Jennifer died.
Yeah, they start really diving into this here, but I find it kind of hilarious that they consider baseball adversarial. That is not a word I would ever use
right.
to describe baseball.
Right.
But okay, sure. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the game wouldn't be worth playing if we knew how it was going to end. And the phrase they came out with after that, the aliens used to explain it then, you value your ignorance of things to come.
Yeah.
Like that. Wow. I never thought about it that way. But yes, you value your ignorance of things to come.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's a saying that I can remember. You know, I think the first people I've ever heard say this was Aerosmith. Life's a journey, not a destination. Now, I'm sure they didn't create that phrase. I'm just saying it's the first person I ever heard say it.
Sure. Hey, I mean,
life's a journey, not the destination.
The whole Miley Cyrus song, right? The climb. It's not about the journey. It's about it's not about, wow, can't even quote songs now.
You're gonna have to help me out on this one, Matt. I've never been a big Miley Cyrus person.
The second half of the refrain, basically. It's ain't about how fast I get there, ain't about what's on waiting on the other side. It's the climb.
Yeah. Almost so many country songs are like that as well. You know, it's about the journey. This is a human value that we have. And yeah, like it sounds weird, but yeah. And let me tell you what, if I miss, just as a spectator, if I miss a game, whether it's football, baseball, whatever, if I know the score before I get a chance to go watch it, it's not worth watching to me.
Oh yeah.
Like I'm likely to not watch it if I know who wins.
That game example was, yes, so good.
Yeah.
Like it's not worth playing if we knew how it was going to end. Cause yeah, I have a hard time going back and watching old game, like the only like old football games I really go back and would even consider watching the entirety of is like the Super Bowl.
Right.
And it's usually where the Packers win the Super Bowl.
Of like, the team that you like who just won.
Super Bowl 31.
Yeah.
I've watched multiple times.
Sure.
Any other football game? Not so much. I've seen highlights multiple times, but sure. I haven't watched the entire game again. Mm-hmm. Why would I do that?
Right.
Unless I'm a coach and studying the tape, that's a different thing. But even then, uh-huh, they usually, you know, condense that film down.
Exactly. Yeah. That I think I can honestly say, outside of watching a Super Bowl in which my team won, mm-hmm, the only time I've really gone back and voluntarily watched a game that has already been played that I knew the outcome of, or was from a previous season altogether, was when I was doing film study for my other podcast.
Sure.
For my football podcast. Like, that's it.
That makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. If you need to watch for another purpose, but you're not watching it for the outcome. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Like that. But yeah, that explains once again why so many people, like, if they have an event they have to go to during the game, mm-hmm, they're always so strict about, you know, don't tell me, don't give me updates. I don't want to know how it ends.
Yeah.
That's a whole, you know, spoiler alert, right?
Exactly. The whole spoiler thing. Yeah.
That's where that comes from. It's, mm-hmm, people don't want to be spoiled. People don't want to know what happens. People want to find out for themselves, right, whether it's good or bad. Mm-hmm. They want to find out for themselves.
Mm-hmm. And it's hard, Matt. You know this firsthand. It is hard to keep somebody unspoiled so that they can experience something for the very first time.
Absolutely.
Especially when it is something that has been out for well over a decade.
It's mainstream.
Yeah.
It's not like some little indie culture down in the depths, mm-hmm, 12 people know about it.
Exactly.
You're going to be number 13.
Yeah, it's hard. It's tough. But this is something that we value. And it's not just sports, though. I mean, because, and that's the metaphor is sports, but sports are a metaphor for life. That's life too, right?
Yeah. It's just sports are something the majority of people can relate to, or at least, uh-huh, even if you don't care about sports, you understand that analogy. The metaphor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You get the analogy. Exactly. Exactly. But Ben says, so why do you exist? Or they say, why do you exist here? And they flash back to this moment in Ben's life. We'll come back to that in just a minute. Back at, mm-hmm, the station, they have arrived at the mouth of the wormhole, but there is no wormhole and there's no Dukat. Ruh-roh, Rorge. The Cardassians are here too, and they don't believe a word of anything. They demand the unconditional surrender of the space station. Well, that was quick. And they only have 1 hour, or they'll open fire. P.S. The station has no shields or weapons to defend itself, thanks to the Cardassians in the first place. Action, action, action. Got to, uh-huh, put something in danger while we figure this other thing out.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Create dramatic tension.
Got to give, like, the captain's gone, so got to give the rest of the crew something to do.
Yeah, got to create dramatic tension. There we go. It always strikes me, though. They control the space station. They pull out, and it's a matter of days where they go, we demand the unconditional surrender of your space station. We're going to take it over.
I didn't even think about that. Yeah. They up until a few days ago had control of this thing. And right. Now it's like, oh, we want it back.
What?
Well, honestly, you could probably just storm in and take it because there's some dissent among the crew right now because it's a mishmash of everybody. Yeah. They don't know what they're doing.
Right. Right. Well, Act 8 is going to finish up the episode for us. Let's get through it. Time is counting down and no one has any intention of handing over the station. They have just 1 hour, but that means they're going to have to hold out for 19 more hours until the Enterprise can arrive to defend them. Let's see what happens. Meanwhile, back in the wormhole, Ben doesn't understand why the aliens keep bringing him back to the Saratoga. He He exists here. So Ben asks for the power to take them somewhere else, but then one of the aliens starts appearing as Kyle Paca and repeats the line word for word that the real Kyle Paca said earlier. We cannot give you what you don't give yourself. Look for answers within, Commander. And Ben finally gets it. He finally faces this moment in his life. Even though he was dragged off this ship, he never really left it. For 3 years, he's just existed here in this moment. He hasn't moved on yet. He wasn't prepared for this, and he never figured out how to live without her. He chooses to exist here, but this is not a linear existence. This is the antithesis of everything Sisko has been trying to explain to them. Finally, Sisko realizes all of this. He's able to grieve, and he's able to let go of her, and starts to leave this moment behind.
The wormhole aliens are essentially the universe's best psychologist.
Move over, Troy. We're taking over. Yeah, that's pretty much it. That's
what it breaks down to. Yeah, I mean,
yeah, but it's such a pointed message. You never moved past this moment of grief. This is not linear. This is counter to everything that we exist as humans. You have to be able that. It doesn't mean don't grieve, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that you should just move on without thought of what came before. But there is a sort of how do I say this where it doesn't sound so cold and like a jerk. You know, there is a, you've got to move on. This is a linear existence.
Yeah. You got to let go.
Yeah. Yeah. You've got to let go. And we see what it's caused in Ben's life for the last 3 years. He's been at Utopia Planitia shipyards, and now he's about to give up his career. And you know, he's just never got, it's eaten him up. It's almost taken his life. And you see how he reacts to Picard and, you know, his disdain for really service. And yeah, he's going to do it to the best of his ability, but he doesn't really want to be here. He doesn't really want to live. So whatever. Right. Until he can finally get past it and he moves on. And wouldn't you know, back on the station, 1 hour is up. Kira fires all that they have across the bow of the Cardassian warships and then puts on a bluff that would make Riker proud. Just when we think the bluff is working, the Cardassians call their bluff and begin assaulting the station. Pew, 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 things blow up, damage to the station, and more people get hurt. And just when it looks hopeless, the wormhole opens back up. Out comes Sisko and the runabout, followed by Gul Dukat's ship, who calls off the assault. Now with Sisko back on board the station, he's walking noticeably a little lighter, a little taller, with a big smile on his face as soon as he sees Jake.
Yeah, and this is an interesting scene because it's the point I made about the Cardassians always having knowledge of everything, right? Uh-huh. And now they're like, wait, how do they install them without our knowledge?
Right.
Well, come on, put two and two together. Right. Occam's razor, let's do this. Uh-huh. So, and they kind of come down to, oh, it's just a massive illusion. They don't really have these things. There's no way.
Right.
So yeah, we're going to blow them up. But
by the way, this particular scene became part of what made the premiere episode so freaking expensive, because they built all these sets and then they blew them up and then they had to go rebuild them again so they could continue with the show, and made things quite more expensive than it normally would have.
They had Star Trek money by that point.
They did have Star Trek money. I want to say, Matt, and I don't have this as an official note somewhere, but I believe that I heard that they had a larger budget for this episode than they did for Star Trek VI, which, if you remember, they just made like 6 months earlier prior to this. They had a bigger budget for this than they did Star Trek VI.
Well, I mean, it's the length of a movie, so.
It is. Yeah, yeah. Well, to wrap up the episode, station log. The wormhole aliens have agreed to allow passage through the wormhole. The Cardassians are gone and the Enterprise is back. Picard and Sisko are together again, discussing how this is about to be one of Starfleet's most important outposts, a center for traffic and commerce. Sisko asks Picard to ignore his request for a transfer. Picard kind of balks at it at first, but Sisko assures Picard that he is certain this is where he wants to be. Captain Picard accepts that as good enough and wishes Sisko luck. And with all of that said, life finally seems to be underway, finding a new normal, and our adventure here on Deep Space Nine begins.
There you have it.
There it is. And Matt's left going, what did you just get me into?
I'm just hoping things settle down a little bit.
Yeah. I'll be honest, I'm still not entirely sure what you mean by that, but I will let you watch more episodes and you can tell me if you feel like it's settling down.
Okay.
Let's see here. Any notes that we didn't cover while I was in here? Let's see. Hey, fun fact. This episode had 250 special effects shots, 81 of them being full-on visual effects. Creating the Battle of Wolf 359 was a big one because it wasn't shown back in Best of Both Worlds. Mm-hmm. The miniature of Deep Space Nine that they created for this episode. They actually created several, but the largest one was the miniature was 6 foot by 6 foot that they used to shoot. They sold that miniature in a crate at the Christie's auction for a whole lot of money. And that thing is beautiful. I've seen it. It is gorgeous. Gorgeous.
Have you seen it in person?
No, I've seen just seen it like on TV, like in shots.
Okay.
I mean, as we, obviously you can imagine the detail that's on it, because it was the film prop replica, yeah. Right? Like it's just amazing to look when you see it, like not on a star field and you like just sitting in a warehouse with somebody's hands on it. Like it's just gorgeous. Anyway, this episode had actually 24 minutes of footage cut out of the final episode. One of those scenes, and actually I kind of wish they would have left this in there. And the director really wants them to put all these scenes back in because he says it completes the story. That may be a little bit about what it may not have been as confusing. Yeah, it really may not. But one of those scenes was where Sisko actually returns the orb to Kai Opaka.
Okay.
Sends it back. This episode was nominated for 4 Emmys. It won one of them for outstanding achievement and special effects. The other nominations were for art direction, sound editing, sound mixing, and the composer for the brand new theme song and everything. He also won an Emmy. So I guess that actually makes it 5 Emmys, and they won 2. I think that's it for the notes that I have that are worth talking about here tonight. Matt, time to boil it down. Mm-hmm. You've started your adventure here on Deep Space Nine. We've got a little bit of Next Generation left. We've got a whole lot of Voyager left, among other episodes or among other series. But what are your thoughts outside, I know you think the episode was a mess and all of that, but just as we start this idea of Deep Space Nine, you've met the prophets, you've met the new crew, you've certainly met the Cardassians, and you know what they're capable of just from what we've seen in Next Generation. What are your thoughts as we begin this new adventure into yet another series of Star
Trek? I mean, I'm not so hot on this episode, but I am very curious to see where Deep Space Nine goes.
Fantastic. Fantastic. I would ask you if you would watch this episode again, but the only correct answer there is yes for when you go back to do your big rewatch. And it's this one, I'll be honest, this is very much necessary viewing to understand as most pilots or premiere episodes are, you know, you've got to know what's going on. All right. Well, Matt, our next episode. Yes. Is going to be another Deep Space Nine episode.
Wow.
I have debated whether or not to do this one, but I think this one is important for reasons of getting out of the pilot and understanding what Deep Space Nine is like in a day-to-day life. And I think it emphasizes and clarifies some things from the pilot episode. So the name of this episode is called Past Prologue. Plus, there's a character you absolutely have to meet you haven't met, and you're going to love this character. At least I hope you're going to love this character. Anyway, that said, there's no extra viewings between that episode and this one. I think this is episode 3. I want to say in production order, it was the second episode that was produced. It doesn't really matter. We're not going to do the episode in between, but this will be Past Prologue. We're only, by the way, for the folks out there wondering, we're only going to do 4 episodes from season 1. So this is the second one we will be doing. Matt, that's going to do it for us this week. And that's going to do it for us in our premiere episode here on Beam Me Up. Hey, what did you guys think about this episode out there? What do you think about getting us started here on our run through Deep Space Nine? What episodes would you like to see covered? I am making the Deep Space Nine episodes right now, and there's still just a little bit of time to get in any Next Generation episodes you might like to hear. Matt, tell the folks where they can get in touch with you if they want to talk to you about anything you've said today on today's show.
You can find me over on Twitter at AsAMatterOfMatt.
And if you guys want to get in touch with me, you can find me at Brent Allen Live across all the social medias. I would love to connect with you there as well, too. Until next time, folks, live long and prosper.